medicine for doctors and hospitals. We can reduce your malpractice premiums. We can reduce the need for excessive testing. But will those savings be passed along to the public, to your patients? Capitalism is the greatest system in the world, but if it has a defect, I'd call it the Exxon Valdez effect. The hint of an oil spill off of Alaska will raise prices at the pump all over Tennessee in minutes. But oil can go down several dollars a barrel, and we won't feel the benefit of that for months. Well, if we lower some of your costs, will you share those with the public? A number of leading medical societies have said yes, but less than 1%. That's not good enough. And some other folks who have been franker have said, we'll have to wait for a generation of doctors to die off before we will change practice patterns in America. I hope that's not true. Because when a Dr. Koop says that as many as one-third of medical procedures in America are unnecessary, and I think your National Academy has backed that statement up, we should be able to reduce costs for everybody in America when we no longer have to prescribe those unnecessary tests. There are many other parts of healthcare reform. The press has tried to focus on the differences between my plan and the Clinton plan. And I appreciated the even-handed testimony that Dr. Coleman of Scottsboro, Alabama gave when he came up a couple of weeks ago, because he pointed out how close the Cooper bill is to the Clinton bill. There are a great many similarities. In fact, of all the bills in Congress, ours is the closest. But there are some key differences, and they're worth stressing. Before I do that, let me tell you the story, though, of the president when he visited with the Pope on the Pope's recent visit to Denver, Colorado. You may have heard that they visited together on a high Rocky Mountain lake. The president and the Pope went out in a little rowboat together, and the wind blew up, and the Pope's little hat blew off. So the Pope asked President Clinton if he would help him and retrieve the hat. So Bill Clinton got up out of the boat, walked across the water, picked up the hat, walked back. And the Pope was pretty impressed. The newspaper folks with their telephoto lenses were on the shoreline. They recorded every moment of this. And the newspaper headline the next day read, Bill Clinton can't swim. You know, there's there's a negative way to look at almost anything, and a lot of the press reporting has dwelt on the negative. It's important, as your national leader, Dr. Coleman, did, to look at the positives and at the negatives. We think, if you look at the first issue of universal coverage, that we're closer than most people acknowledge. We think that of the 39 million uninsured Americans today, we can cover them and on the president's timetable. And this was omitted in your Academy's testimony. The president's timetable is not this year or next year. It's 1998. It takes time to cover everybody in America. It takes time to find each one of those 39 million people and get them included. I wish there were a faster way to do it. But universal coverage is not like a light switch. You can't just flip it on. I wish it were that easy. It's more like a dimmer switch. And our bill is 80% bright without blowing any economic fuses. Let me explain how. First, user-friendly health insurance. For the first time in our lives, anybody in America, anybody, could get health insurance if they want it without fear of being turned down by the insurance company. They could get that coverage at low group rates as if they worked for the biggest company in town. They could keep that coverage no matter what happens to them, no matter how sick they are or have been, no matter where they work, no matter whether they work. In the jargon, these are guaranteed issue benefits at near community rating, with a ban on pre-existing condition limitations, a ban on experience rating. Insurance companies would not be able to skim the cream off the market or pick the cherries off the tree, not seek the young, healthy, wealthy people. They'd have to deal with everybody. A long overdue reform, and we share that with the Clinton bill and with the Chafee bill. In fact, we go one step further. We would allow the average citizen to be able to deduct the purchase of health coverage. Whatever portion of low-cost basic coverage that they pay, that person should be able to deduct. Today, corporations can deduct anything they want to. People usually cannot deduct even one penny of even the most basic health policy. That's a $54 billion program that we have in our bill that's not in the administration bill that we think is very important to help with the affordability of health coverage. But for folks at the low end of the income scale, as I mentioned earlier, we want to cover four times more folks. That's about the same as the president's proposal, up to about 200% of poverty. He has two different criteria. For one group, it's 150% of poverty. For another group, it's 250% of poverty. But for 3 years now, our bill's been at 200% of poverty. We think that that will do a lot. In fact, 60% of the 39 million uninsured in America are within this income range, 200% of poverty or below. We commit to covering those folks immediately because, as I say, we're paying their bills anyway. We might as well go ahead and manage the problem. But right there, with user-friendly insurance and a new Medicaid program, you solved 80% of your problem. Do you then need the employer mandate? We think not. We think it's a clumsy and expensive way of completing the job. 30% of the uninsured have no contact with an employer. So an employer mandate is not going to reach those folks. Hawaii's had an employer mandate for some years. Do they have universal coverage? Not by most standards. And Hawaii is a group of islands. You generally know who's in Hawaii every day. We have no idea who's in Tennessee every day. So we think that we can complete the job with a follow-on bill in a couple of years and still be on the president's timetable of getting every one of our citizens covered. Another key issue is cost containment. And here I was quite surprised to see not only your society endorse global budgets, but the American Academy of Surgeons went so far as to endorse the Canadian approach last week. We need to make a big distinction here between what works on paper and what works in practice. A global budget, in my opinion, will not really work in practice. First, let's focus on the word global. Watch out when you endorse something like that. Global in the healthcare context means that the government has a right to limit private sector, individual, after-tax expenditures on health. I don't think so. That doesn't sound American to me. It doesn't even sound constitutional. Shouldn't Americans be able to spend their own money after taxes on whatever health treatment they choose? Without government interference? It's their own money. They earned it. This is a free country. This is the land of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, a global budget says, no, the government has a right to tell you what you can do, even with your money after taxes. Doesn't that go a little far? That's the word global. Look at the word budget. Look at Congress's track record in enforcing budgets. Do you remember Graham Rubin 1? How about Graham Rubin 2? How about Graham Rubin 3? You think we're going to enforce a budget? If it pinches, which budgets are supposed to do, we'll chicken out. What works in terms of cutting and cost containment are markets. Markets are tough. No congressman ever wants to be around a hospital when it closes. But some of our hospitals at least need to adjust the uses of their beds, if not close. 40% of the hospital beds in America are empty every night. And that percentage just grows and grows. Because when we built these hospitals, we did not anticipate home health care or outpatient care. We goofed, as governments often do. Markets are much faster and much tougher at rooting out waste. We think that markets will do a better job of containing costs in a way that's fair to consumers, fair to patients, than budgets will. Rural practitioners have been hurt by Medicare bureaucrats who are all wise and all seeing, just decreeing for years that our expenses are lower in rural areas, therefore we get less reimbursement. And there's been almost no persuading them. For years we've fought against that disadvantage. Markets are more sensitive. Markets know that, hey, supplies cost as much or more in rural areas due to the transportation charges, and the labor markets are a lot larger than bureaucrats, yes? Because folks, even in the most rural parts of Tennessee, are driving into Memphis and Jackson and Nashville and Knoxville and Chattanooga for the higher-paying jobs. There's not as big a wage differential as people guess in Washington.